Good evening. My name is Don Ecker, the show UFOs Tonight. You're listening to the Cable Radio Network. Well, you know, before we get into tonight's show, I've got to mention something. Today, of course, being September the 17th, 1994, it's kind of a special day to me. About 8 years ago, back in 1986, when I was in the field of law enforcement and ended up being injured to the point where I had to medically retire, which ultimately brought me into this field of UFO research. My dad and mother came out west to visit me while I was in the hospital for quite a while, and they were here for about a month when they had to go back home. And when they did go back home, my father found out he had been ill for some time, had found out that he was quite ill, and ultimately he ended up leaving us on Thanksgiving Day, 1986. And the reason I mention this is that today, September the 17th, would have been my father's birthday. And I couldn't leave the show go without mentioning something about that. My dad was kind of an unusual fellow. A career military officer, 25 years in. A guy that, quite frankly, he and I never quite saw eye to eye most of the time I was growing up. But be that as it may, we still, of course, loved each other. My dad was quite a special man. I can actually only ever say I saw him lose his cool one time. That was back in 1974, when my sister was having her second child, and it was in the middle of winter. We were having a severe storm at the time, and her husband at the time was in the Navy, was away from home, and she was staying with my parents. And it was on a Saturday in January of 1974. And it was not too long after I had come back from the service and had, as a matter of fact, just gone on my municipal police department, became a policeman for the first time, when I got a call from my mother that was kind of frantic, wanting me to come out to the house. She wasn't at home. She, as a matter of fact, had to go into her office that day. But my father had called her and said that he had called for an ambulance. My sister was in labor. So I jumped in my car and ended up driving out there. And I got there well before the ambulance did. And it was probably a good thing, because my father, the 25-year career military officer, was climbing walls. And I ended up, along with my aunt, delivering my sister's second child. And it was a good thing my aunt was there, because by that time, and they raised Irish setters, she had delivered something over the years, like 50 puppies. So between it all, it worked out pretty well. But my dad just couldn't hang in there that day. He was having kind of a tough time. But over the years, as we got to know each other better, I understood a lot where he was coming from. And Pop, wherever you are today, we miss you, and I love you, and happy birthday. Well, tonight's show is going to be kind of special. We have back with us from his extended trip to Germany, Mr. Dwight Schultz.
I have back. Yes, I had a lot of beer and was treated very nicely by my German forefathers and foremothers. Everyone wanted to know where I came from in Germany, and I told them. It's very nice to be back. I missed the show last week. I told everybody on the American time of this radio program and which satellite and which transponder they could catch us on if they could get a bounce.
And everybody knows those Germans love to bounce.
Yes, indeed.
But it's great to be back, and I had a very good time at a Star Trek convention.
Yes.
You were over there Star Trekking it up. Now, I don't know if we're going to have time tonight, but in the next week or so, and I'm going to throw this out for all you listeners, make sure you remind Dwight if I forget. But while he was over there, Dwight went to Castle Frankenstein.
Frankenstein, yes. And I can't possibly tell you that story because it was a six-hour
ordeal,
a feast with a suckling pig. We had a knife and we ate with our fingers sauerkraut on pork, on pate, and they made us eat with our fingers. And I want to tell you, I licked my fingers because it was good. But they still serve fat in Europe. Huge pieces of fat, and people smoke, and they drink, and they sit back, and they call it repast. And it was wonderful. It was great to be there. Yes.
It's not quite like sunny Southern California.
No. Vegetarians. In fact, we had a few vegetarians at the meal, and one of them practically heaved when they brought the pig in. It was unbelievable. I can't eat that. Oh, my God.
Anybody you want to mention by name?
No. Because actually, they're very nice people, but it's just that you realize culture. I mean, you know, we've changed and transmogrified and transformed ourselves several times over. They're still eating the food that they ate 300 or 400 years ago, and you know what? They're not fat. The Germans aren't fat. They're all thin. I mean, Americans are tubby.
It's the beer they drink.
Too many carrots.
Well, tonight, now that we've got that out, remember, Castle Frankenstein.
I will stay at to the real Castle Frankenstein. Now, let's get on with the show.
We have a special show tonight. As we promised last week, I have in studio with me Mr. John Andrews. Now, John is one of the honchos, and I guess we could say manager, John. You're the manager of the plastic division?
Division manager, yeah.
Division manager of testers. Now, of course, testers are the folks that make all those really neat model kits. Now, you may wonder just what in the world does that have to do with UFOs? Well, we have, as soon as Vicky stops knocking the radio studio down around our ears here, we have in studio that Mr. Andrews himself brought and presented to me something called the Area S4 UFO Revealed. And it is a huge, huge kit of the saucer as described by none other than Mr. Robert Lazar. John, I want to thank you for coming in. You had a heck of a trip all the way up here from San Diego. It's a pleasure having you in here, and I've been looking forward to doing this this show. Welcome.
It's my pleasure, Don. Thank you for having me.
Tell me something. UFOs, that's a far cry, John, from what you usually are involved in. Now, you and Tester have been responsible for basically breaking some of the top secret aircraft development as is developed by our government, the Air Force, people like Lockheed. I guess in a way you could be equated to Aviation Week and Space Technology magazine for leaking stuff that some people would rather not have leaked. Is that correct? Is that pretty close?
Well, I think, Don, what it is that some people have said they'd rather not have it leaked, but actually, if we didn't have it, obviously it was leaked already. We just gathered it together and focused on it and produced plastic scale model kits.
Well, a number of years ago, there was a project that was known collectively among the intelligence community as HAVE Blue, which was, I believe, the predecessor.
It was a predecessor to the F-117 stealth fighter, yes.
And you folks made a kit, which you called the F-19 aircraft, which Tester released.
Yes.
And it was, according to the information you had at the time, it was what your intelligence people at Tester, and from the information you were able to grab, what you thought the stealth fighter may in fact be like.
Well, what we did at the time, Don, is that we knew we wouldn't be exactly like the real F-117, but in the model we incorporated the basics of stealth design. We had weapons carried internally. We had swept back wings. We had a two-dimensional exhaust. We had the canopy was pointed just like on the F-117. We did a number of things that touched on the stealth technology. Actually, when you take that F-19 model and you lay it on top of a drawing of an F-117, you look at it and you say, my gosh, the wing sweep is approximately the same as the averaged out. We even called out the engines that were in the actual F-117, and we called it out several years in advance what they were. We just do our homework. We watch things, we read things, we talk with people. I'm a member of the Aviation Space Writers Association. That's a professional organization, and we get around. We have our annual meetings, and I have some access to the aircraft industry, to the military. They're not telling me secrets. They can't. And actually, I don't want to have secrets told me. But on occasion, you hear some very, very interesting things. And it's kind of like a large jigsaw puzzle where you get a piece here, a piece there, you put it together, and after a while, you begin to see the picture. So that is part of what we do. We're actually, in essence, a small CIA. We operate exactly the same way. We take little bits and pieces, put it all together, and see what we can come up with.
Testers has been in existence now for how many years?
Tester was born in 1929 at the height of the Depression. Niels Tester decided to produce some glue to enable people to glue cardboard into their shoes to cover the holes that people were wearing through. Obviously, at that time, there was a need for the product, and that's how the company got started.
I can recall back in the very early 1960s, and a model kit was released. And let me think now. Good Lord, it's been many years ago. I think of the USS George Washington, which was a nuclear submarine. And there was quite a bit of brouhaha about that when it was released. I can remember this, and I was just a kid at the time. But the big problem among many people was, well, here we're showing the Russians, the USSR, what our nuclear submarines are all about. And any Russian spy can go in and buy a kit and take it home, put it together, and they know what type of weapon systems we have. Do you encounter the same thing like now? We're talking, what, 32, 33 years ago. But do you encounter the same type of thing like that with some of your military models?
We encounter that. I know the background on that kit, and they were a competitor of ours at the time, and that was Revell that did that model. All that they did was to do the same things that we do, read every publication, gather up pages and bits and pieces, and finally put it all together, and they did the model. I'm sure the Soviets were doing the same thing at the same time.
I noticed here, John, in the back of this pamphlet, well, let me look here to see. No, we're good yet. I noticed in the back of the pamphlet that you have several new kits listed that Tester will be putting out in the field before long. One's called the SR-75 Penetrator, and the other is the XR-7 Thunder Dart. Now, the Penetrator is, according to this brochure, suspected to be the replacement for the SR-71 Blackbird. And the Thunder Dart may in fact end up being, if this is correct, what many people have suspected for a long time and have called Aurora. But probably it would be more accurate if we called it Senior Citizen. Yeah. Is that basically what this kit is supposed to represent?
Yes, basically that's exactly what it's supposed to represent. We go and do the best we can based upon bits and pieces of information that come from a lot of people actually across the globe who send us little bits and pieces of information. We put it all together as well as reading the technical journals, and we come up with something such as that. We had shown this at a trade show in the winter of 1993. The NRO said, no, such a thing cannot, no, it doesn't exist. The NRO has since upgraded their answers to people inquiring to the point of where they now say, instead of, no, it doesn't exist, they now say we can neither confirm nor deny. So they've given us an upgrade in the past year, and it's just a matter of time of seeing how right we've been on something.
Now, this is the aircraft, the one that is called the XR-7 Thunder Dart. This is the aircraft that is suspected of being the donut on a rope trail leaving aircraft?
Yes, because it has what they call a pulse detonation wave engine in it. In our particular model, we put two of them on the model because of just thinking in terms of the engines being reliable, that type of thing, and that's what we've done. The engines were actually bench tested, not the engine on the airplane, but smaller engines were bench tested at the Naval Postgraduate School, the Officers Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, many, many years ago. And they discovered that this is a pulse jet engine that will run at idle on a table without great compression of air, and you can throttle it by changing the frequency of the pulse. I would imagine that this thing probably sits on the ground just throbbing away at a frequency lower than 30 cycles per second, and when they really want to go with it, they'll just change the pulse frequency and take it off and fly it.
Well, it says here, John, and of course we've heard this bandied about for quite a while anyway, that it may be capable of speeds exceeding Mach 8. Now that's 8 times the speed of sound. I have heard estimates that the quote-unquote Aurora, or probably more properly known as Senior Citizen, may be able to achieve Mach 15, all the way up to Mach 15. If that's true, and of course we as civilians have no way of knowing, but if it is close to being true, what is keeping this aircraft from burning up? How high does it go, or what's your best estimate? And let's get to the bottom line. Many people have suggested that there may be, in fact, here it comes, alien technology that is somehow incorporated into this. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I would say that that's possible with regard to alien technology. At the same time, I have to think in terms of the fact that we have made a lot of progress with materials such as ceramics, that type of thing. You talk about altitudes, our best guesses are putting it somewhere at about 140,000 feet altitude.
Nothing could touch it, could it?
Well, that's the point. I mean, if you go back and you look at the history of the Air Force and the reconnaissance airplanes from the, you know, take Lockheed's U-2. Well, they just took an airplane and made it fly at 75,000 feet, or just a little bit under 75, and it was well above the MiG-15's capability, and it performed very well. When the Soviets reached the point of possibly knocking out U-2s, why, all that the Lockheed and the Air Force did was to produce the SR-71 and of course the predecessor CIA A-11 and A-12 airplanes, and they just flew higher and faster and exceeded that defense weapon. In the case of these airplanes, I would imagine that all we did was once again expand that envelope of this aircraft to get it outside of the range and the speed capability of the enemy's defensive capabilities.
Well, you know, getting back just briefly to the idea of our government having their hands on recovered alien technology, regardless of where that may have come from, I keep going back to a series of news specials that was put together by George Knapp, formerly of KLAS Television down in Las Vegas. And Knapp, during this series of specials about UFOs, at one point spoke with Ben Rich on the air. I have that at home. I have the tape at home. And the question was asked of Ben Rich, and for you people that may not know who Ben Rich is, Ben Rich was for many, many years the gentleman in charge of the Lockheed Skunk Works, the guy behind so much of this black technology. Ben Rich was asked if it were true that any alien technology may be involved in some of the more recently developed aircraft that we were just hearing about, like the F-117 and so forth. Now, many people may suspect that somebody like Ben Rich would have done a great belly laugh and just, you know, rolled his eyes and said, alien technology? But no, he didn't even blink. He didn't even smirk. This blew me away. He looked at the camera and he said, no, it's just good old plain American technology, which to me suggested that he did not in any way find the idea of alien technology to be ludicrous. What is your feeling about that?
Well, let me just say one thing about Ben. He's been a very, very dear, good friend for a good number of years. He doesn't tell me any secrets. I wish that he would, but he never has. But Ben has said that all things are possible. That was a quote directly from Ben Rich. He also said, relative to the UFO business, he says, be careful. There are some charlatans out there, so be careful of that. And I think we've all discovered that in the passage of time and in our researching. But Ben is of the feelings that all things are possible, without saying directly that it is alien technology. I think he's the type of a man, an engineer and a scientific type, who keeps his mind open. He doesn't close it, he doesn't say no, and as all of us probably sitting in this room right now know, you must never, never say never. Because you just don't know. Tomorrow things may change, and suddenly you're presented with something entirely different.
Okay, John, we're going to have to take a very quick commercial break, and we're going to be back in just a moment. My name is Don Ecker, the show UFOs Tonight. Joining me in studio tonight and helping me once again very graciously with the co-hosting duties, Mr. Dwight Schultz, and our in-studio guest, Mr. John Andrews, who is the division manager of Tester Corporation, up here talking about black aircraft. And we're going to be back after this. And we are back. Okay. I have the brochure here that you wrote, John. And basically, this is what is included with the kit, the Area S4 saucer kit. And there's some fascinating information in here. It basically is a very quick but very thorough thumbnail sketch of what the UFO field has been all about. You start this out the background talking about UFO sightings, which were very common in the latter part of World War II. And as we all know, they were called Foo Fighters. And then as we get along, of course, comes that perennial favorite, the Roswell crash. And we're going to be talking about Roswell more this evening. But let's get to the bottom line, the S4, that area known as S4. Do you give credence to this area? Do you think that there is something out there still that may harbor recovered alien craft? You have done a very open-minded sketch of the overall idea of saucers, the Lazar story, back engineering, and so forth. And testers must give some credence to this because they've marketed this kit. What's the bottom line on this?
Well, I think we felt, being a commercial enterprise, we felt that it was time to do a UFO. Secondly, I've been in this business long enough, and I've watched the UFO phenomenon for a long enough time to know that I always had the feeling that somehow, somewhere, someplace, I would have to do what I would think would be the actual UFO in a model kit form. When Bob Lazar came on the scene, and he talked with George Knapp and went on television and told people that he had worked out there at S4, which is adjacent to Area 51 or Groom Lake. We got in contact with Bob, and we thought, well, it might be the time. I interviewed Bob in his home. I've got tape recordings of conversations with him. There is no way for myself or Tester Corporation to be absolutely sure that what Bob said is absolutely truthful. However, there is no way to say that he's lying either. The interesting thing in the 5 years that I've known Bob is that his story hasn't changed one iota. He, unlike a lot of UFO people who give talks and lecture and conduct trips out to Groom Lake, you ask them a question and they fill space with an answer. Bob is one of those people that if you ask him a question and he wasn't connected with a particular aspect of the program or wasn't in a particular part of the craft, he says, I don't know, I didn't work on that. That's a very refreshing touch, and it's one of the things that at least made Bob Lazar believable to me. I do not know, absolutely, if he's telling the truth. I personally think that he is. He had told us once about a sound that he had heard out there, that he was in a bus being taken over to the S4 area. And through the front of the bus, as the bus turned, the sides of the bus were thumping. They were 32 cycle pulse, heavy sound. And we just kind of dismissed that. I was out at Groom Lake two nights in a row and heard that sound. Once in flight, the second night we had went up to the edges of the perimeter and listened to it. It started up and it stopped and sounded like perhaps something had broken. Came back after that trip, went over to Bob's house in Las Vegas and explained it to him. He says, that's it. That's what I had heard. And suddenly, the things that Bob say with the passage of time are proven to be true. Even though when you first hear it from him, it is so remote and so hard to believe that you want to say no. But then time passes, and then suddenly you realize the guy was telling you the truth.
Well, you know, John, I know Lazar. I've been down there. I've had him on this program a number of times. I think I've done two actual shows with him on it, and I've done several more with his friend Huff, Gene Huff. And I've got to tell you, I have kept my mind open about this for a long time. That's not to say I totally accept it, and I don't totally reject it, because I'm privy to some information that I just don't know how he would have had this information unless he was somehow connected with his project. However, that leaves several other areas open that are also uncomfortable. Number one, he suggested that at one point he may had been administered some type of drug which affected his memory. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Yes.
The other thing is, and which opens the door to a whole lot of things. Okay, it opens the door to many things. But then the other thing is, how could anybody, and knowing Lazar and having somewhat of a handle on his personality, not a lot, but somewhat, and let's face it, this guy marches to the tune of a different drummer.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Praise be.
He marches to the tune of a different drummer. This guy is so blasé about something that, to me, would just absolutely, I'd still be on the floor gasping if I would have been in the area doing what he claims to have been doing. How do you explain that? This guy, that just strikes me as very odd.
May I just say something here? See, to me, that is what intrigues me. That is what makes it real to me. It's like the first time you flew. How the first time I flew, I was in another world. Maybe for the first week afterwards, I was in another world. Now I've flown 300-400 times, and I'm blasé. This man talks about something extraordinary in a way, it seems like he's familiar with it, as opposed to recreating it every time you talk to him. It's familiar. It's there. It's concrete. It's not having to be fabricated, as so many people seem to be doing when you talk about this. To me, that is what makes it plausible.
Bob is a very, very interesting man. He's got a great sense of humor.
Yes.
He was never a true believer in UFOs. He was never part of the so-called UFO community. He didn't even want to go public with this whole story, but his friends told him, Bob, you've got to, due to the fact that they had gone out there, he had brought a number of people out to the perimeter of Groom Lake, and they had seen something, and they got caught by the guards, and Bob was inside working on a program, and he knew it was over for him. But they said, Bob, if you don't tell this story, something can happen to you, and I think that has merit, that physically something might have happened to Bob Lazar.
You mean something physically?
Something physically to cover this secret, but he had to go public. And many times this has happened. You know yourself that oftentimes people have got to go public to save their own lives.
Okay, John, let me ask you to hold just there and hold that thought, and we'll pick up there when we come back. But we right now are at the bottom of the hour. Tonight we are bringing back something that many of you have been requesting. Tonight Vicki is going to once again start up the UFO update and media information, and we are that's kind of a treat. And when we come back, more with my guest, Mr. John Andrews, myself, I'm Don Ecker, Dwight Schultz, the name of the show, UFOs Tonight, and you are listening to the Cable Radio Network.
Here's the UFO news and media update for September 17, 1994. Everyone knows the Air Force released a 23-page report attempting to write off the 1947 Roswell crash as a highly classified mobile balloon. It was sent aloft to monitor Soviet nuclear testing, they said. The Soviets, of course, didn't detonate their first nuclear device until 1949, a full 2 years later than the Roswell event. The report is chock full of other credibility gaps, which will be thoroughly covered in the next issue of UFO Magazine. Meanwhile, Representative Stephen Schiff, the New Mexico congressman who directed the General Accounting Office to implement a record search on Roswell, calls this Air Force move a preemptive strike against the forthcoming GAO report. Why? Once again, the Air Force has been caught red-handed lying. Not too long ago, the Air Force told Schiff they had absolutely nothing on Roswell. But now, the story goes, there's actually 2,500 pages of documents, supposedly all available at the public viewing room of the Pentagon. Well, this Pentagon plot thickens. Stay tuned. Now this. Turn on the tube. Sightings will begin its fall season tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Fox TV. That will be followed later by NBC's Unsolved Mysteries at 8 p.m. PST, featuring UFO personalities George Knapp, Bob Lazar, and Britain's own Timothy Good. Also on Fox, watch for UFO reports on the widely acclaimed Encounters. Season premiere date to be announced. Finally, the producers of an upcoming UFO-themed movie of the week have been changing its working title as often as coffee filters. Last we heard, it was called Deception, and it deals with a fake UFO landing. Watch for it on CBS. That's it for tonight. This is Vicki Cooper. I'll be back with another UFO news and media update next week. Now, back to Don Ecker and his guest John Andrews on UFOs Tonight.
All right. Well, after, 2 years, she finally came back and did it. John, let's get back to this idea of physical harm. This is the United States of America. I'm going to play devil's advocate for just a moment. I mean, this is a land of laws, of morals. This is a place where we have freedom of speech, where the question of national security and secrecy and democracy do not seem to be mutually compatible. And what you're suggesting is that there are still elements somewhere within the deep, dark bowels of national security that would authorize premeditated murder?
I think so. I think the record is very, very clear that there have been a number of cases that there was a CIA agent that was shot on the steps of a building in Washington many years ago. We've just had a case that is still, as far as many are concerned, unresolved of a particular attorney to the existing president of the United States who may have had a problem. We've got the Marilyn Monroe case that still stands out there, and people say something happened to her. And of course, we have a president, JFK, that maybe something happened to him that was wanted by somebody.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that something.
Well, I just kind of word it that way because there may be a lot of people who just don't believe in this type of things. I'm saying that you have to consider the possibilities. There are strange things that happen in this world. And yes, we have all these wonderful rules and laws and morals and whatnot, but there is also a great deal of money, a great deal of power, and a great deal of efforts of various people to stop certain things or to gain things.
In the UFO field, there was a case that I investigated and I wrote, as a matter of fact, ended up being a three-part series on somebody that you know, somebody that's been a guest on this program, Lee Graham. Graham, who of course is an employee of Aerojet, works on the DSP spy satellite, and was not long ago on this program with Ron Reguera, and we talked about that a little bit beforehand, alleges, and I checked it out, and it seems to be damned legitimate that he was set up in an attempt to have his security clearance pulled by an incognito Air Force general and an FBI agent who visited him at his place of employment. And according to their regulations, when somebody comes in to see somebody, especially like Graham, who has a security clearance, works on classified material, their security supervisor should have been there. The FBI agent asked the guy to leave. And they then exposed Graham to classified material for which he did not have a need to know. In order to, the only conclusion I can come to is to yank his security clearance because he has been such a pain in the government's patootie with Freedom of Information Act requests and has been all around brilliant pointing out where they have lied. Now, during this period of time, and as I found out later as I was investigating it, when that was happening at his place of work, you were being visited by an Air Force colonel by the name of Barry Hennessy, who was from the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, which had some kind of a tie-in to this business with Graham. What was that all about?
I haven't the slightest idea what that was all about, except for the fact that it did happen. Barry Hennessy showed me a letter that I had written to an industry executive, and he says, I wish you wouldn't use this term. I wish you wouldn't do this or do that.
The term being senior citizen?
No. No, it had something to do with stealth. And the code name for stealth, Senior Trend. Yes, an NF-117. I had that designator. And so we agreed not to use it. And at the same time, Lee was being set up in his office with whatever was happening there. The interesting thing in it is that I don't think Colonel Barry Hennessy, Air Force Office of Special Investigations, had any business being in my office at all. It was actually an FBI function. I should have had an FBI man in my office. We have no government contracts. I have no security clearance.
But you've been tied into the black budget aspect of this for a long time because of what you do.
As a matter of study, but there was an Air Force officer in my office, in essence, presenting me with a document and telling me not what to state anymore. He didn't say it directly, but he says he wished that I wouldn't use these terms.
Was it an implied threat?
No, there was no threat. There was no threat. I think they're very smart about that. They know better. The other side of it is that they know that I'm also a very responsible citizen. And I agreed not to use those terms anymore.
But yet they would turn around and use those same code names mm-hmm. on a man mm-hmm. in order to pull his security clearance.
Yes.
In essence, taking his livelihood away. Because
yes.
simply because he was exercising his American rights.
They had presented Lee with I guess it was a DD-213, which is the document that he signed at that time because he felt intimidated. Under his circumstances, I could understand that. Mm-hmm. I could really understand.
He
that.
Had a security clearance. He's in the business.
That's right.
Right, and they can apply pressure there, and they can manipulate him in ways that they can't. Manipulate a civilian, for which the CIA certainly shouldn't have. I mean, they're not supposed to be operating here.
But you know, we wrote to that Air Force General Kirby, mm-hmm. Michael C. Kirby, and how Graham found out who this man was in itself was very mysterious. He came through C.B. Scott Jones, a former naval officer, 15 years naval intelligence, who's had a very close tie-in with naval. With top secret material and UFOs, somebody that was affiliated with Senator Claiborne Pell, and C.B. Scott Jones, who would have known Kirby because Kirby, in fact, was an Air Force liaison to the Senate.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Let me see. I guess we are right now. I've got four people waving at me here. I guess we got to take a break. This is one part of this job I hate. We get on a roll and we got to take a break. We got to take a break, but when we come back, we are going to start taking your phone calls. So all you folks, as a matter of fact, they're all lit up except one line. I have one line open right now, but when we come back, we're going to start taking phone calls. And here's how you can can join in tonight's conversation.
If you're in the 818-213 or 310 area codes.
Okay, we're back. Let's hit the phone lines. We're going to go to Brian in Albuquerque, who's joining us on satellite. Good evening, Brian.
Hello, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I have a couple, just a quick comment. I wonder if you guys would comment on my comment.
All right.
Kind of built on the advocate tonight. you claim that this vehicle probably can go 15
Mach 15,
right?
Right.
Now, if they had that kind of technology where it wouldn't burn up, why wouldn't they be using that on the shuttle? I mean, don't they all work? Aren't they working together? Why do we still have to use tiles, special tiles on the shuttle? And also, on the government's report that they come out with on the weather balloon, or on the balloon that would monitor Soviet tests, wouldn't? I kind of read the article a little bit different. Maybe to me, I thought that they meant they were testing this balloon. I mean, wouldn't the government start a test like that before the Soviets actually ever did anything to see if it worked? I mean, I hear you guys kind of reporting that the Soviets weren't testing at the time, which is true.
Well, I have a 23-page report, Brian. I have a 23-page Air Force report, yes.
Okay, well, I don't have that.
Right. And you know, I think what you're talking about basically is from the AP reports,
right.
The Associated Press reports that were out. And I have, I have all of the reports that were released last week. And what is not in the AP story and what is misrepresented in the AP story in itself could be a show. But let's get back to your question to John about the tiles on the shuttle and this new bird. John, that to me strikes me as a good question.
It's a very good question. At the same time, we have to look back and realize that the tiles on the shuttle are very, very old technology. Secondly, I mean, we've come a long, long, long way with the use of ceramics. Also, there are changes in the mission requirements. You don't have to have something quite as good as might be on this new airplane on the shuttle. The shuttle re-enters for a very short time. This airplane is going to be running at that speed, at that temperature, as part of its mission for a long, long time. So I think there's been a passage of time. And unless we have access to that material or the reports on it or how it's made, we really don't know what its capability is. But always bear in mind, this nation has moved rather rapidly. In fact, a lot of nations on this face of this earth have moved rapidly technologically, trying to deal with the heat problem, because it's a very, very important problem.
So, and this aircraft,
is this an airplane or a saucer? That's where I'm coming.
No, it's an airplane, but this aircraft, if in fact this is a new composite material on this, well, let's call it the Aurora for sake of ease. If the Aurora is made of a new composite, this is still, I would imagine, top secret, and this material would not be available for regular aircraft manufacturing.
There probably is no need for it for other aircraft at this point in time.
Okay. Brian, we got to move along. You betcha. You have a good evening. Keep looking up. And we're going to go to Ralph in Escondido, who's joining us on Dimension. Good evening, Ralph.
Yes, it's a great show as usual.
Well, thank you.
As you know, I'm an engineer, and I've worked in avionics and aviation for quite a few years, and very interested in these advanced aircraft. I'm trying to get a copy of that Roswell report through Duke Cunningham's office, and I would urge all your listeners to do the same, to show that the congressmen are running for office now, and now is an ideal time. Your previous caller said that it would have been wise to test the so-called Mogul balloon in 1947, and he was absolutely correct. That's probably one of the few things in the report that makes sense. According to Pseudo-Platov, who was interviewed on the Red Bomb Discovery series, which, by the way, boosted his credibility. There were several moles operating at Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory, and it would have been prudent and smart for the United States to test that Mogul balloon years ahead of their first atomic blast in 1949.
Well, let's not forget also, Ralph, that it was not long after this that the Mogul Balloon Project was declassified and phased out. They went on to other things. Basically, what they had aloft that you know they were launching were acoustical devices to monitor noises in the air. Now, what the Air Force stated in this report, and they kind of deflocked Carl Flock, was Flock had mentioned that it was probably launch number 9. The Air Force said no, launch number 9 was accounted for. It was probably launch number 4. Now, this is after they told Schiff's office that they had zero documents on Roswell. Then suddenly, as Vicki mentioned during her update, they came out with over 2,000 documents they suddenly located. Now, as it turns out, Kevin Randall, who, along with Don Schmidt, wrote The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell, has a copy of a diary from one of the physicists that were associated with this Project Mogul, a fellow by the name, I believe I'm pronouncing it correctly, Crary or something like that. At any rate, balloon launch number 4, according to his diary, okay, was consisting of meteorological balloons. And during this launch, they were able to track this from the ground, although not from the air. The only launches that there were no information on were the ones where nothing happened or they completely lost them. However, launch number 4 was accounted for. Now, this is what the Air Force claims probably came down at Roswell. There is nothing unusual about this particular device. According to his diary, the balloons were meteorological. So, in other words, they would have been familiar to anybody that had ever seen a balloon. So it just doesn't make sense that they would have, number one, not been able to have been identified. Number two, left a debris field in excess of a couple of hundred yards wide and up over a half a mile long, and could fool people like Major Marcel, who was the intelligence officer of the 509th.
I have a few questions for John Andrews. I would like to get in touch with John directly here in San Diego, because I have a number of sources and some very interesting information about advanced aircraft. I'm an engineer myself, and as an engineer to an engineer, I think you might find some of these things very interesting. Is there a way I can get in touch with you here in San Diego?
Ralph, we're in the phone book.
Okay, I'll look in the phone book under tester.
Under tester, yes.
I've built many of your models. Lazar,
thank you.
Lazar claims that this craft uses a gravity wave propulsion. Has he ever described how that was measured, the gravity wave?
You know, I don't think he described it to me, because I am not one of those theoretical physicists.
Uh-huh.
However, I don't know if you're familiar with a magazine called American Scientist. American Scientist, September-October issue 1994, has an article on page 422 entitled Space-Time Hypersurfing, and it describes how space-time is warped with a spacecraft. And the interesting thing about it, this is exactly what Bob Lazar was talking about 5 years ago. And now the way this article, the first sentence says, in some future history, 1994 may be remembered as a year that the warp drive was first conceived to be a physical possibility. Well, I'm afraid Bob beat him to it by 5 years. I really don't know that question that you asked about how it was measured. Bob talks about the fact that there are two types of gravity, an A and B gravity.
Yes.
We have that in a little brochure that we include in the plastic model kit, in Bob's words. For me, it's way outside of my field of expertise, which is plastic injection molding, and I really don't even want to try and answer that one.
Yes, there's a Nobel Prize in it if he has. The Navy worked and spent hundreds of millions of dollars on a program called the A9, later the AX, known to a lot of insiders as the Flying Dorito. Could this be the so-called Manta that's been seen, the A9 or the AX, a prototype perhaps?
I'll go back to Ben Rich's comment, all things are possible.
Okay, Ralph, we've got to move along. The lines are lit up, but I want to thank you. As usual, you had some excellent questions. Keep looking up, and we'll talk to you later. Let's go to line one. We've got Lee. Lee, where are you calling from?
Monrovia.
Oh, Lee Graham. Okay.
Lee Graham.
We got Lee Graham on the line. How you doing?
Oh, can't complain. Good evening, Don.
Good evening.
Good evening, Vicki. Good evening, Mr. Schultz.
Good evening.
And good evening, John.
Hey, how you doing, Lee?
Oh, can't complain.
Good.
Hey, I want to thank you for mentioning my name on your model kit.
Yeah.
And, well, you know what I'm going to ask.
Well, you've always been one of those sounding boards, and you and I have had great discussions over the telephone lines and in person. So why not?
I mean, as you know, that I don't believe in Mr. Lazar's story.
I know that.
The principal reason, of course, is because of the Project Snowbird document and the Project Aquarius document. In that document, these are aircraft, not spacecraft. And you know that I was given the Project Snowbird document from Bill Moore to give to you, for you to give it to Ben Rich. And you might explain to the audience there that Mr. Ben Rich knows what Project Snowbird means.
Well, I think we have to explain that, and as I've explained it to you, Ben Rich merely said to me when I mentioned Snowbird, he said to me in a phone com, if I had used that word, I would be in jail.
Mm-hmm.
He did not state what it was.
Mm-hmm.
He did not tell me what it was. All he said was that if he used the word, he might be in jail. So
mm-hmm.
That's all I can say. That's mm-hmm. that's what Ben said.
All right, Lee, let me ask you, what is a Snowbird for the benefit of the audience?
Snowbird is the last page in the Project Aquarius document where it states that they're flying a recovered alien aircraft in Nevada. And Nevada is misspelled, by the way. And earlier in the document, it mentions this aircraft that it was recovered in the desert of Utah where the aliens had left. And ostensibly, I would assume that Kelly Johnson and Mr. Ben Rich would have had access to this vehicle.
Well, let me ask you this. If, in fact, this is true, if they did recover an alien artifact
mm-hmm.
in Utah, and I'm familiar with the documents you're talking about because we were the first publication in UFO Magazine to run the Project Aquarius and Snowbird documents publicly.
True statement.
I am familiar with this. Could it not be that whomever wrote this might have substituted spacecraft for aircraft strictly as a mistake? Is it not possible that if in fact this was an alien device, it would have had to get here somewhere? There's no air in space, and to quote a famous phrase, nobody can hear you scream in space. So is it not possible somebody might have just wrote aircraft and they meant spacecraft?
No, because if you recall, the document came by way of Falcon, this gentleman that feeds Bill Moore the information, and there are tapes made by Falcon. I have a copy of one of the tapes, and Falcon makes it very clear that the spacecraft are very different from the aircraft. The aircraft being short range, I assume that they're dumped out by the spacecraft that come from this planet Zeta Reticuli.
Okay, so what's your major bone of contention as far as Lazar's story?
Oh, that they're not spacecraft. There are other things that John is familiar with, that why I don't believe in Lazar. He calls it the fourth planet, which it's actually the third planet, which was information that was fed to John Lear, who in turn got fed to Lazar, and in turn John Enders fed back to me, which is actually the third planet.
Are you talking about from the star system Zeta Reticuli?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. All right, I know what you're talking about now.
Okay. It seems that Bill Moore, Falcon had told Bill Moore that they come from the third planet.
But how do we know that Falcon or Moore are telling the truth?
Oh, we don't. Except that Lazar claims to, or John told me that the information about the fourth planet had come from Lazar. Well, the information had originally come from Bill Moore, but Bill Moore changed it to the fourth planet when he told it to Lear to see how the information would come back to him. And it came by way of John to me from Lazar as being the fourth planet. Lazar knew John Lear before he claims to have worked out at Area S4. And of course, we all knew about S4 before Bob Lazar ever came on the scene.
John, what's your response to this?
The only response that I have is that in the little booklet that was prepared by Bob Lazar that we include in the model kit, he is still holding to the fact that it is the fourth planet out. Having not taken the trip myself, I cannot say with certainty that it's the fourth, the second, or the third, not having ever been there. All of us are relying upon information that sometimes comes from somewhat, spurious sources. I mean, certainly Bill Moore has that tradition. I'm not sure about Falcon Lee. As you know, I've said many, many times that I sometimes wonder if Moore wasn't being set up, and he later on said that he was. So once again, we've got this big central problem of exactly what to believe and who to believe.
It's kind of like the argument of how many angels can dance
right
on the head of a pin.
Yeah. One of the things that we're very clear on, and Lee, I don't know if you've gotten the instruction sheet for the kit.
Yes, I do. I got it from Ron Regier.
Okay. Well, if you notice that we have several places where we mention the fact that this may or may not be true.
Mm-hmm.
We present the story of the kit and Bob Lazar and what he said in the hopes that somebody may say, gee, I'd like to have a model kit of a UFO. They get the model kit of the UFO. They get the instruction sheet. They read other things and take an interest. We do not say this is absolutely the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
We do mention the fact that we tried to get the IRS, Naval Intelligence, and a prominent nuclear physicist to tell us if Bob Lazar was lying.
Mm-hmm.
All three of those parties, whether they be a singular party such as the physicist or a group such as the IRS, refused to answer that question. And all I asked was that they say Bob Lazar is a liar and sign it. No one would.
Okay. Well, we are almost at the top of the hour. Lee, we've got to move along.
Ooh.
I want to thank you for your call. Keep looking up, my friend. We are going to go to Jim in Eagle Rock. Jim, you have a minute.
Hi.
How you doing?
Second question, real quick. Did they test the Aurora in 1992 or 93 at Edwards Air Force Base, or a type of craft like that? Because my friends who lived up in the North Valley, every Thursday from about 9 to 12, the place shook. But it was only every Thursday. And it was not a joke. There was vibration. Of some sort or other.
Jim, I think it's very possible that they might have been testing a power plant. I don't think they would have been testing the airplane, but they may have tested the power plant, placed it aboard a C-5 or a C-130 or whatever, and taken it out to Groom to install it in an airplane. It's very, very possible.
Yeah, because they said that the walls would vibrate like an earthquake, but there was no earthquake on those days.
Yes.
But it was every Thursday at that certain time, and they mentioned it, and I thought, yeah, it was weird. And you were the one I thought I'd ask, because you'd know, you know.
Oh.
So that's my one-minute question.
Okay, well, by golly, you did a good one, Jim.
Okay.
I'll tell you what, the next time I'll keep you on for 3 minutes.
All right. Thanks.
Okay.
I'll take you up on it.
Yeah, Jim. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, we are at the top of the hour. My name is Don Ecker, the show UFOs. Tonight, you're listening to the Cable Radio Network. Tonight, we are taking a foray into the wonderful world of black budget aircraft and reverse alien technology, reverse engineering, who knows? But we're going to explore it, and when we come back, more with my guest in studio, Mr. John Andrews, along with Dwight Schultz, myself, Renee, and Vicky. So stay tuned, and let me say what Larry Sanders always says, don't flip that dial.